American Art Museum. Tickets available through Ticketmaster, 612-673-0404.
6 minutes past 11 o'clock. Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Ankton. Glad you could join us. Mark Dayton and voter turnout. Those seem to be the two big stories coming out of yesterday's primary election here in the state of Minnesota. DFL voters selected former state auditor Mark Dayton as their candidate for the U.S. Senate race against incumbent Republican Rod Grams, and they did so by a comfortable margin. But when all was said and done, when all the numbers were added up, despite the millions of dollars that were spent on all the various campaigns, very few Minnesota voters actually voted yesterday. Today on Midday, we're going to take a closer look at those stories coming out of yesterday's primary. We'll also take a look at some of the other interesting results from yesterday's voting, the matchup in the 4th Congressional District, for example. And we'll be looking ahead to the November general election. Chris Gilbert, chair of the Political Science Department at Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, has joined us here in the studio. We'll be checking in with several of the candidates over the next couple of hours, and we invite you to join our conversation as well. Basically, we're talking politics today on Midday, specifically looking at the results from yesterday's primary, looking ahead to the November general election. We'd love to have you join our conversation. Give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. Chris, thanks for coming in today.
Good to be with you, Gary.
Now, I suppose before we start, we should actually go down the list of election results for people who haven't been following this all so closely as some of us have. In the U.S. Senate primary, Mark Dayton won the race, as we noted, 41% of the vote. Mike Cerisi, second, 22%. Jerry Janicich, third, 21%. Rebecca Yanish with 15%. Rod Grams was essentially unopposed in the Republican primary, so obviously he won. In the Independence Party primary, James Gibson won that race with 47% of the vote. Leslie Davis, second, with 25%. Buford Johnson, 20%. Fred Askew with 8%. Constitutional Party, Minnesota's fourth major party. David Swan defeated Derek Schramm, 63% to 27%. There were lots of people paying very close attention to the results of the 4th District congressional primaries. The DFL primary, Betty McCollum, the endorsed candidate, won that race by a surprisingly large margin, 50% of the vote. Steve Novak was second at 23%, Chris Coleman 19%, Kathy Hartnett at 8%. In the GOP primary, Linda Runbeck was essentially unopposed, so she moves on to the November general election. Closely watched Independent Party primary in the 4th Congressional District. Tom Foley defeated Pam Ellison, 63% to 37%. Now, some of the other congressional races, the primaries that were held yesterday that didn't get as much attention as the 4th District, but deserve some mention this morning. In the second, these are all Republican primaries now. In the 2nd District, Mark Kennedy defeated Joe Wagner. In the 5th District, Frank Taylor defeated Chris Flynn. In the 7th District, Glenn Menzie defeated Alita Eden. Interesting contest up in the 8th District. The two candidates are virtually tied, and so there'll probably be a runoff to find out which Republican will have to face James Obistar. Bob Lemon and Warren Nelson, 50-50, with virtually all of the votes counted. Other, besides the 4th District DFL primary, congressional primary, one other one in the 3rd District, Sue Schuff defeated Daryl Stanton, and Sue Schuff will now face incumbent Republican Jim Ramstad. And an Independent Party congressional primary to report on. This is in the 2nd District, and Gerald Brecky defeated Stan Benz. Couple of legislative races. Actually, there were several legislative primaries yesterday, most of them fairly one-sided affairs with the expected winner winning handily. But there were a couple of interesting results that we should pass along in District 56, basically over in the Stillwater area. Michelle Bachmann unseated longtime State Senator Gary Leidig, this in the Republican primary for the State Senate in District 56. In 59B, Phyllis Kahn faced what was thought to be a fairly stiff challenge from Brian Beal. Phyllis Kahn, a longtime House DFLer, she won handily, as it turns out, in District 67B. In the St. Paul area, Sheldon Johnson defeated Ali Zhang in a fairly closely watched race. Another one in St. Paul that got some attention was the Randy Kelly race. He defeated his challenger, David Murphy, 74% to 26%. So, Chris, a quick overview of all the election results. Any one of them jump out at you and say, wow?
I don't think there's too many surprises, Gary. The margin of victory for Betty McCollum in the 4th Congressional District DFL primary was probably a surprise to many people. It seemed like Steve Novak had run a lot of advertisements, certainly has had a good reputation, as Betty McCollum has built in St. Paul in state legislature. And the backlash, if there was one, against the DFL-inspired advertising in favor of Betty McCollum really didn't materialize. It certainly didn't help Novak at all get over the hump. So I thought Betty would probably win. She was the endorsed candidate of the party. There has been a push for a long time in both parties to finally find a way to send a woman to represent Minnesota in Washington, D.C. And Mr. Foley is still there as the Independence Party candidate, but it's obviously a pretty good chance right now with Linda Runbeck on the Republican side for the 4th Congressional District.
I guess I misspoke. I said there was going to be a runoff in the 8th District. That's not true. There's going to be a recount.
Probably a recount. There's a couple other races, mainly because of the vote totals are so low where the recount might be there. The 2nd District Independence Party is a 12-vote margin the last time I looked on the Secretary of State's website. So recounts are going to have to happen fast because we're only 8 weeks from Election Day. It's really quite a sprint for all the candidates, especially ones who face significant battles to get the nomination in the first place.
Why did so few people vote yesterday?
It was dreadful. Less than 20%, I believe 16 or 17%. Sense the figure being quoted. For one thing, and I've said this before, Minnesotans are skipped in the presidential selection process, and I think that does tend to have, being part of the presidential selection process, does tend to have the effect of tuning people into politics earlier. We certainly wouldn't want to run these primaries in March or April when the presidential races are going on. That's probably too soon. But when there's no attention to it, it just takes a long time for people to clue in. Secondly, both parties, perhaps particularly the DFL, need to continue to think about the message voters are sending them about the present process of a caucus system leading to conventions and endorsements in June, and then a three-week gap before we get to the election. Any momentum and political interest that might have been built through what are often some interesting battles at those June conventions dissipates completely through the Minnesota summer, maybe more so than other states. A lot of people away or doing other things or enjoying their leisure time, and people don't really clue back in. And Dayton was able to capitalize on that by building up a lead when some people were clued in, which I think really helped him to hold off the challengers in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and in fact to extend the lead that he had. Minnesotans just really never turned on to this. I found that a little surprising with the DFL. When you think back to the early stages of this race, you had seven people who jumped in, and I think most observers would agree those are seven people, all of whom would make good United States senators. Two more, Tim Penny and David Mingy, who chose not to run, but I think who also would have made very credible showings. That's pretty good for a party. And yet at the same time, you had the DFL party chair, you know, late last week essentially indicating it might be better for the party in terms of helping its endorsed candidate if less people showed up at the polls. And that suggests something that's wrong with the system. Minnesota voters are continuously telling the parties that the way in which we get to the primary isn't working, and they tell them that through not selecting endorsed candidates, and it's twice in a row now for the DFL, Mike Freeman in 98 and now Jerry Janicich, and they're also telling that through the apathy. Essentially, Minnesota voters have decided they can wait whoever emerges from these primaries, and now is the time, we presume, now is the time to clue in, especially in a presidential year. But 16 or 17% primary turnout in a presidential year is strikingly low.
Let's zero in on the top of the ticket race, the U.S. Senate race. Mark Dayton versus Rod Grams, it seems on the face of it that you couldn't find two people at different and further away from each other politically unless you had Rod Grams and Paul Wellstone.
Rick McLuhan, the Independence Party chair, is fond of telling us, I think, every time he's on your show that there's a one-party system, there's no difference. And Grams-Dayton, I think, is an answer to that in many respects. It's a very clear contrast. Two people who have been involved in politics, Mark Dayton for a longer period of time. Rod Grams has never lost an election. He's also never received 50% of the vote in a general election. He has benefited from, I think, a very good focused campaign style from third candidates who've tended to take votes from his opponents. And Rod Grams also ran the last two times in what turned out to be decent Republican years. Benefited from the Sikorsky scandal in 92, benefited from Arne Carlson's coattails in 94. That stuff is not likely to be there. Nevertheless, and despite the low favorability ratings, Grams has done well when he's gone out on the stump. He has, I think he's always underestimated by the DFL and to some extent underestimated by those who analyze campaigns, but he has gone out. His message is very simple and straightforward. I would almost call it Reagan-esque. A very consistent, simple strategy, tax relief, fiscal responsibility, standing up for average citizens. And his comments last night to the various media organizations reflected that in some respects it doesn't matter so much who the opponent is when the message is so simple and clear. And for Mark Dayton, he had a lot of success highlighting issues that appealed to the relatively few people and skewed toward older age brackets who were going to show up in that DFL primary. But the important part is not just that he had name recognition and not just that he was out early and had the resources to run the ads. The ads were good. I mean, you can spend all the money in the world, but if the ads aren't good, if voters don't respond, it doesn't matter. But the ads showed substance. They showed an understanding of issues that mattered, and they showed clear plans. And I think that that tends to put a candidate in a very good light. And if he can put together that kind of race with those kinds of resources, and I think be able to outspend Grams, which is rare when you're facing an incumbent, that makes for a very interesting race, and I suspect a close race as we head to early November.
Now, there are going to be other Senate candidates on the ballot besides Rod Grams and Mark Dayton. One of them is James Gibson, who yesterday won the Independence Party's nomination for the U.S. Senate, and Mr. Gibson joins us this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Gary.
Getting enough sleep? Are you ready for the general election campaign now?
Well, no, I didn't get enough sleep. The election results made for a long evening. I think we didn't get a really total, for sure, situation until about 11:30 last night, and I still had to give my campaign speech.
Are you, you entered the race in March of 1999, as I recall.
Yes.
Did you, at that time, believe in your heart of hearts you were going to get this far?
Well, I knew there was a strong possibility that if I just kept plugging away, learning what I had to do to run a campaign, making the contacts, just getting out there campaigning, that I could get this far. I knew I had the tenacity to stick with it, so, yes.
Mm-hmm. I would think that this general election is going to be pretty tough for you. What with all the money that the Republicans and Democrats can spend, the candidates, both of them, are better known than you are. I would think it's a tough hill you have to climb.
Well, I'm sure it is, but I think all of us would like to believe that it isn't just about money, that issues matter. And as long as I'm able to be across the threshold and to be in public forums and talking about issues, I think anything could happen in Minnesota. The governor has pledged to be very involved. That's going to help quite a bit. I think whatever the governor tapped into in 98 is still there. It's just a matter of awakening it.
What issues are you going to focus on?
Well, the theme of my campaign is intergenerational justice, and I mapped out. I can talk about any issue in that framework, but the four I mapped out, I want to see the surplus used to repay the national debt. I want Social Security to move from a pay-as-you-go system to one that's fully funded so that we can divert funds or deductions from individuals' paychecks directly into their own accounts. I'm going to make a strong education statement, and I'm very strong in the environment. Those are all intergenerational justice issues. The last issue is campaign finance reform. I'm going to push hard on that as well.
Mm-hmm. When do you officially get started? Today?
Well, yes. Today was it started rather early. I had an interview over at Channel 9, so yes.
Well, congratulations to you, Mr. Gibson, and we'll be talking with you over the next several weeks.
Thanks very much.
Good talking with you. James Gibson, who won the Independence Party's U.S. Senate nomination. Chris Gilbert is here from Gustavus to help us take a look at the election results from yesterday's primary election, and look ahead to what we can expect in the November general election. And again, If you'd like to join our conversation, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll be hearing from several candidates during the course of our midday program today, and coming up in a few minutes, we'll have some material from Mark Dayton's first press conference as the party's Senate nominee. Chris, does Mr. Gibson have any chance at all to influence the Senate race in your mind?
I don't remember if you and I talked one day after the 1998 primary. We would have said that Jesse Ventura had almost no chance, and we know what happened. I think it's going to be difficult. He doesn't have the personality that Governor Ventura had. Conditions are different. Both major candidates failed in most respects to reach voters. Both Humphrey and Coleman, the campaigns just did not reach beyond their bases and really didn't even excite the bases of the party, especially on the DFL side, which was very surprising. Ventura was able to exploit that. He out-debated them. He certainly came off better. And then in the end, he had equal or better resources than those other two candidates in the last week of the campaign. Now, which of those things is likely to be there? In some respects, it's unfortunate that the stakes and the expectations have been raised by the Ventura victory for Mr. Gibson. In any situation, in a typical situation, a double-digit showing for a third candidate is good, and I think that's probably how we should be evaluating the Gibson campaign. The base of the Independence Party in Minnesota is not much more than 10%. The party chair hoped for 15,000 people to vote yesterday. If you add up the Senate candidates, I think you get to just under 6,000. Of course, that was true all over, but it shows the base is not tremendous. Gibson will probably be part of debates, and I think that will help him a great deal. But can you capture lightning in a bottle? And I don't mean to minimize the importance of the governor's victory, but can you capture all those elements that have to come together and work in your favor, particularly when there's a presidential race with two candidates who I think will appeal to people in their parties? It's going to be real hard to do. Success for the Independence Party still means maintaining major party status in Minnesota, double digits, continuing to sort of slowly but surely build themselves into being contenders in a lot of races, not just one big one or a series of races scattered here and there. And with Gibson and Tom Foley running in the 4th District, and somebody who's run before, I think they have that possibility. But victory, you'd have to say, is unlikely at this point.
Jackie's on the line from Edina. And Jackie, I understand you were an election judge yesterday?
Yes, I was an election judge yesterday in Edina, Precinct 9, and I think he had like 1,700 registered voters, and 400 voted, and halfway through I had this thought that we always get the preconceived totals before the, election, and so it kind of almost acts out itself when, with Joe and Grohl used to give us predictions and all these others. So do you think that has a negative effect when we're only expecting a 10%? It gets people thinking, why should I vote? They don't expect me to vote anyway. It's a nice day. I'd rather, go walk around Lake Harriet. And I don't know if that has any effect on why people don't show up, but that was my thought midway as I was reading a book and eating and trying to pass the time away.
Sounds like you had a much higher turnout in your precinct there, though, than statewide, about 25% versus 16.
Yeah, uh-huh.
So not so many people were affected anyway. Thanks for your comment, Jackie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're doing something right in Edina to be well ahead of the curve. My view is that most people, if they're going to vote in an election, there has to be a large share that want to get interested relatively early. There's no question that when people hear through the news cycles as the election approaches, either that one person is well ahead, and I think that may have something to do on the DFL side, especially in the Sunday Star Tribune reporting a sizable lead for Dayton, and when the expectations are relatively low from the state, from the DFL party chair, as we mentioned, that not many people are going to show up. It does have a sort of a downward spiraling effect, just as a lot of interest in a campaign, the presence of somebody new and different or something new and different, think Perot 92, think Ventura 98, tends to boost that turnout at the last minute. The spiral works in both directions, and I think we were caught in a downward trend. I don't think that's necessarily the candidate's fault or the media's fault. I think we've devoted good coverage and substantive coverage to what's now a four-party, major-party system in the state, but for whatever reason, it just didn't catch on with voters, even what should have been a pretty hot Senate race with interesting candidates, with a lot to say, with a lot of substance and high stakes, defeating Rod Grams, helping Gore to win the state for Democrats. That's a big deal. And perhaps taking the Senate back as well. The Democrats would not be able to do that unless they took the Graham seat. And it just didn't happen. And the poll results at the end probably reinforced the notion that there wasn't much at stake, and therefore relatively few people turned out. The ballot was pretty short in most places. I think from the party I chose, I had one choice to make, and all the other seats were one person. So that doesn't help either, that there's really not many races.
There was a lot of attention being paid before the primary to the endorsement system, especially in the DFL column, and whether or not the Democrats had finally picked an endorsed candidate who could win the primary and end up as a potential office holder. Well, statewide, the endorsed candidate, Jerry Janicich, for the Senate race, finished third. In the 4th District, the party's endorsement process held up better, Betty McCollum winning handily in the 4th District. Joining us now is State Senator Ember Reichgott-Young, who has been pretty critical of the endorsement process as it's played out. Senator, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
You are a good DFLer. Do you see what happened yesterday as a victory for the endorsement system, or yet another nail in the coffin?
What I saw yesterday is what I suspected, and that is that at least on the DFL side, our endorsement system is very strong at the legislative level and the congressional level, but it breaks down at the statewide level, and that is a major concern. And yes, I did support Jerry Janicich, and I voted for him, and I think he would have made an excellent senator. But now we congratulate Mark Dayton and move on. He will have the full resources of the party. There's an iron there, though, Gary, and that is this. Mark Dayton was one of the candidates who did not appear before the DFL state convention last summer, and yet he will now get the full resources of the party. So there's the irony, and you just question, was it worth it to get the endorsement?
Was it?
Well, I think that in the future we need to really look at that question. I don't think it will carry value at the statewide level, at least for a couple of rounds. Here's why. Next time around, you're going to have statewide offices like governor, and those offices are more limited in the amount of money that you can spend, like maybe $2 million. Most candidates will take the public financing and therefore take the spending limits. If that's the case, this is the choice that a candidate will have. That candidate has to decide whether or not to spend maybe $500,000 seeking the endorsement and whatever value that brings, or save that money and put it in ads at the end right before the primary. Well, given what's happened the last two cycles, if I was one of those candidates thinking about running statewide, I'd have to think long and hard before I devote that kind of money to the endorsement system.
Does winning the endorsement actually result in anything for a candidate? In other words, Jerry Janicich this year, did the party give him a lot of money then once he got the endorsement? Did they deliver millions of volunteers for him? What did he get when he won the endorsement?
Well, my concern at the start was he wouldn't get much of anything, because that's about what happened in 98 for Mike Freeman. But this year, I will credit the party. They did give him more. They gave him some commercials, I believe, that Paul Wellstone made. They did give him a sample ballot. They gave him a few things. But again, the race was so different this year that unfortunately it didn't have much as much effect. And that's because there were no limits on the spending in a federal race, and the dollars were just off the map. But again, if they can do that next time around, it will help, but it still is just a minimal amount of effort. The vast majority of the effort seems to go to the general election candidates, and there's a feeling among a lot of the party leadership that we should be spending our money to fight against Republicans and other candidates, not DFL candidates.
Do you think the party would be wise to move to a candidate endorsement system? In other words, rather than just pick a winner at the state convention, the delegates at the convention would look over the candidates and say, well, A, B, and C are all acceptable. They're good Democrats, so we can put our imprimatur on them, but candidate D over here is a loser.
I personally think that's a great idea. We have actually talked about that in the legislature. We called it ballot access, and that came out of the Grow Commission a few years ago, where a candidate would have to go to their respective party convention, and if they got 20% of the votes there, or some number, they would have access to that party's ballot. Then you might have an endorsement of one of multiple candidates, but you'd have to have some base of support at the convention, come to the convention, talk to the folks and then before you could actually have access to the ballot. I like that idea. Another thing we've talked about, Gary, is that what do we do about this primary? It's so late. Many people would like to move it up. Maybe what we should do as a party is not endorse until after the primary, but if we do that, then move the primary up to June, and that way we as a party can coalesce and get our resources together in time for the general. If indeed Jerry Janicich had won this election, he would have been starting with a bank account of zero again and would have had barely 8 weeks to rebuild for the general election. We are fortunate that Mark Dayton doesn't have that problem, and for that reason I think Mark is going to be a strong candidate and he will win. But in the case of a regular candidates, they have a very tough road to hoe when they are facing a general election just 8 weeks after a primary.
The other side of that, though, wouldn't you end up with interminably long campaigns if you had to essentially lock up the party endorsement and win the primary by June? I would think many instances you'd have to start campaigning a good year or two before the actual election.
They already did. They were doing that, seeking the endorsement this year. Many of them were starting and announcing last year. So we already have long campaigns. No, I don't think that's it at all. I think what we'll do is we would do is just focus it on the candidates prior to the June election. And, you know, the problem is, one of the things I found was really difficult about this election was the low turnout. Nobody was involved. So, I mean, I'm not sure how many people were hearing it this year, even at this point. We had 16% of the people voting. So maybe we'll get their attention a different time of the year. We can't do anything but get better on that front. I was so disappointed to see only 16% of the people actually selecting the nominees of the parties. If we put it back in May or April, maybe people are going to be more tuned in early June. It might result in greater turnout.
We have to take a break here, but one last quick question for you, Senator. In the 4th District, the party certainly came to the defense and did a lot of work for the endorsed candidate, Betty McCollum, but the other Democrats in the race, at least two of them, said the party went way overboard in attacking them. Do you think that was a mistake? Is that going to be a problem for the party in the 4th District?
I think Betty McCollum just scored an impressive win. She is a tough campaigner, and I believe she's going to take that race in November. And it's ironic because I think she would have had an impressive win without the party going negative. I personally did not support that. I don't think that's what we should spend our resources for. If the party spends those resources to support Betty, to show her record, to show why she's the best Democrat, that's great. I hope that the party maybe takes a good hard look at that in the future.
Thank you. Appreciate your joining us.
Thank you.
State Senator Ember Wright Scott Young, who was, in fact, an endorsed candidate for Attorney General 2 years ago and was one of the many endorsed candidates 2 years ago, a Democrat who didn't make it past the primary. We're taking a look at yesterday's primary results, looking ahead to the November general election today on midday. Chris Gilbert is our guest. He's up from St. Peter. He's the political science chair at Gustavus Adolphus College. And again, we invite you to join our conversation, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We'll get to more callers, more interviews, and more comments from Chris in just a couple of minutes.
Programming on NPR is supported by Minnesota Lesset, skilled construction laborers and union contractors working together. Online at minnesotalaborers.org.
This week on A Prairie Home Companion, poet Joy Sutphen, the ensemble singers and soprano Maria Jetty, and the Mozart Effect Quartet. Plus the news from Lake Wobegon and much more this week.
Listen for A Prairie Home Companion Saturday afternoon at 5 on all NPR stations and again Sunday at noon on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW-FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
Let's catch up on news headlines. Here's Stephen Johns. Stephen?
Good morning, Gary. A federal judge says it looks like lawyers have worked out most of their differences in the case of jailed scientist Wen-Ho Lee. Lee initially was to have pleaded guilty to a single count Monday, but last-minute legal wrangling kept him in custody until another hearing today. Lee had been accused of mishandling secret data. At the Senate hearing about the marketing of mature merchandise to immature audiences, Democratic vice presidential candidate Joseph Lieberman is calling on the entertainment industry to police itself and stop targeting children with adult products. Republican candidate George Bush is in Washington State today, where he'll unveil a nearly $5 billion plan to spruce up our national parks. There's a change coming involving Minnesota state parks starting September 29th. Annual state park passes will be valid for a year from purchase instead of the current system of using a calendar year. The cost of the 2001 state park permit is $20. A second vehicle permit costs $15. A special permit for Minnesota's residents with disabilities is $12. Experts are encouraging Twin Cities residents to rid their property of standing water after finding three recent cases of La Crosse encephalitis. Metropolitan Mosquito Control District officials say the mosquitoes that spread the disease tend to breed in pools of standing water, like those in old tires, bird baths, aluminum cans, and at the base of trees. La Crosse encephalitis mainly affects children, causing mild headaches and flu-like symptoms. Three children in the western suburbs contracted the virus this year. They have all recovered. And authorities say a resident's candle started a late-night fire in a dormitory at the University of Minnesota last night. No one was hurt in the blaze that started just after 11 o'clock yesterday, but 128 students were evacuated. Firefighters contained the fire to one room. The forecast calls for increasing clouds statewide with a chance of afternoon showers. For the Twin Cities, increasing cloudiness with a slight chance of a shower toward evening. And that's news, Gary, from the newsroom.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. It's 23 minutes before noon. Midday coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. Today we're sifting through the results of yesterday's primary election, and we're looking ahead to the November general election, which should be a good lively one. Chris Gilbert is here, chair of the Political Science Department at Gustavus, and we have callers on the line. We're going to be talking with some of the candidates and some party officials and try to figure out what happened yesterday and why, and what that bodes for November. Now, the DFL winner, or the winner, I should say, in the DFL Senate primary yesterday, Mark Dayton, held his first press conference with just as the party's nominee just a few minutes ago up at the state capitol, and we have some excerpts from what Mr. Dayton had to say.
I had a chance to talk last night with Jerry Janicich and Rebecca Yanish and Mike Cerisi, and I tried back and forth with each other, and we haven't connected yet, but I had really wonderful conversations with Jerry and Rebecca. I'm going to be getting together with Rebecca hopefully this afternoon for coffee, and I'm going to be seeing Jerry tomorrow up in Chisholm. They both offered their full support, offered to help. I listened to, watched Mike's comments on television last night. I thought he was wonderfully gracious and magnanimous. So I think we have a united DFL party in terms of this state ticket, and I'll be going before the DFL Central Committee on Saturday asking for, hoping to receive their endorsement, which will give me that official standing and allow me to work very closely with the party and with all the other DFL candidates for the Congress, for the state legislature, and of course with the Gore Lieberman campaign committee. I had a chance to hear a little bit of Senator Graham's remarks last night and read a little bit this morning, saw a couple clips from the interview, and I must say I'm disappointed that he's off to that kind of start. I'd hoped that we would soon be able to move beyond the juvenile name-calling and the ridiculous exaggerations to get into what I think Minnesotans need, deserve, and demonstrated in this primary that they clearly want, which is an intelligent, in-depth discussion of the important issues and a delineation of our differences among them. And we do have honest, legitimate, and honorable differences on these topics, which are going to determine the future of our state and our nation. And I think that ought to be the focus of the 8 weeks which lie ahead. If he thinks that calling me Mark Liberal enhances his public standing as a United States Senator, I certainly welcome his continuing to do so. I don't think that that's the caliber of campaign that Minnesotans deserve and have a right to expect. And the fact of the matter is that I'm more right for Minnesota than he is, and my proposals are far more fiscally responsible than his. I have run my own business, private investment company, very successfully. I have served as Commissioner of Economic Development twice, put together financing packages with businesses all over the state that helped to create 30,000 jobs back in 1983 to 86. I served as the taxpayers' watchdog as state auditor, an office that audited about $2.2 billion in local government expenditures each year, pushed for greater fiscal responsibility, accountability by local governments, and served on the State Board of Investment, where the decisions that I made then and which followed immediately as a result of those decisions resulted in a $10 billion increase in the value of the public pensions funds of the state within just a couple of years. So I know business, I know government, I know finance, and I also know that Senator Graham's numbers don't add up. And I welcome his challenge for me to be even more specific than I have been so far in my analyses, and those will certainly be forthcoming. I think, however, coming from someone who has steadfastly refused to answer just about every questionnaire posed to him and even meet with media representatives who have attempted to ask him his positions on these issues, I think it's kind of absurd. But I welcome that scrutiny on his part, and I offer that I will do the same. And again, I think that will well serve the voters of the state. By a couple of illustrations, however, I think that Senator Grams has been very reckless in his characterization of Social Security in his website victory line as a Ponzi scheme. It's quoted as saying that it is on the brink of economic ruin. Another direct quote is that even the Social Security trustees admit that the system will soon crumble. The Congressional Budget Office most recent analysis of July of this year predicted that Social Security Trust Fund will be running a $2.38 trillion surplus in the next 10 years. I don't think that's a system that's soon to crumble unless the Congress were to pass Senator Graham's proposal, which would take 80% of the funds going into Social Security and divert them for private investment purposes, turning Social Security then into a national survival contest, which he attempts to justify with numbers that make ridiculous assumptions and which fundamentally mislead and scare unnecessarily our senior citizens and other near retirees about the future of Social Security. Another topic we'll have a chance to debate is his proposal to eliminate the income tax, individuals and corporations, the estate tax, and substitute instead what he claims would be sufficient as a 23% national retail sales tax, which actually is 30% if you even do the basic math correctly. And it assumes such things as one-third of the tax revenues coming from government paying taxes to itself. It also involves a tax on everything, including food, medicine, clothing, which means that people in Minnesota could look forward to adding about one-third to the cost of everything they buy. And to me, that's dealing with the senior prescription drug crisis in reverse. An almanac just a week ago, or 2 weeks ago, he was quoted as saying that one of the reasons to eliminate the estate tax, which is paid only by the wealthiest 2% of the people in America, their estates, was because it costs the federal government 65 cents to administer and collect every tax dollar that it gains from that, given that the revenues from the estate tax are $30 billion a year. That would be a $20 billion a year spent by the IRS to collect those taxes, and I think the IRS would be astonished to know that that's actually the Republican budget figure allotted them. He also claims that he has provided, through his $500 per child tax credit, 80% of all the tax relief since 1992. That amendment, which is a good one, passed in 1997. And as part of the same bill, he and other Republicans successfully lowered the capital gains tax from 28% to 20%, meaning that capital was now taxed at half the rate of income for the wealthiest people in America. And while that tax bill saved working families in Minnesota $500 per child, it saved wealthy investors $500,000 or more in a given year. So I think that this election is fundamentally going to be about priorities, about principles, and about people. Two different views of how we can best move this state and nation into the future and address the needs of our citizens. This election is not, should not be about Senator Graham's or myself. It should be about the people of this state and which one of us can best represent their interests in Washington. I have my views, and Senator Graham has his. We have only 8 weeks to discuss some very real differences, honest, honorable differences on issues that are profoundly important to the economic well-being of Minnesotans for today, tomorrow, and decades and even generations to come. That should be the focus of the next 8 weeks. I pledge that I'm willing to conduct the campaign on that level, and I ask that he do the same.
That was the DFL's U.S. Senate nominee, Mark Dayton. He won yesterday's primary in a fairly convincing fashion. Chris Gilbert here, anything particularly interesting in what Mr. Dayton had to say in terms of what it bodes for the November election?
Well, two things, Gary, one of which I think will hold up, and the other one we'll have to see. First, what I think will hold up are the very clear contrasts and the specifics about some very important issues that face Americans. It may be true that no one issue stands out in this election, but there are a lot of issues that do stand out, maybe not one above the others, but education, the environment, Social Security. These are many of the things that Mr. Gibson mentioned as well. The future of Social Security, quite interesting that Dayton already criticizing the Graham's plan and the Graham's numbers, much as Vice President Gore has criticized Governor Bush's numbers in a slightly different, though similar kind of effect, Social Security reform plan. That kind of substantive difference is going to be brought out again and again and again on important issues. And the second one, we'll hope it holds up, but I wonder, is the nature of the campaign. Dayton said very clearly near the end of our clip there that this is not about me and Senator Graham's. I think that's a way of trying to step aside from some of the problems surrounding the Graham campaign, the allegations about the emails, and to focus it in on ideas. You criticize each other's ideas, honorable differences, I believe Mr. Dayton called them. I think this campaign is not going to remain on that level. I think it will get somewhat nasty, and nasty by Minnesota standards, which may not be nasty by national standards. This may not be Hillary Clinton versus Rick Lazio, but I think it's going to be hard to resist that, to resist personal attacks. The kinds of rhetoric you sometimes hear out of Senator Graham's about public servants. Dayton has spent his life in public service in various ways. The stereotyping that we heard a little bit last night from Senator Graham's, in some respects, I think that's indicative of a little bit of campaign rust. He hasn't had an opponent, and I think they wouldn't have gotten anywhere near what they're alleged to have gotten involved in with emails if they had something to do on the Republican side. But I hope we stay out of the personal side of this, the emails and everything else aside, and focus in on some real differences they have and differences they'll have with Mr. Gibson as well.
Chris Gilbert, by the way, we should note that next Monday, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is holding the first debate of the Senate campaign, Graham's and Dayton, and we'll be broadcasting that live here on our midday program. Matter of fact, we get the honor of going out to moderate the debate, so that'll be coming up next Monday. Besides the Senate race, there was a whole lot of attention paid to the 4th District Congressional primary yesterday, specifically the DFL primary, and State Representative Betty McCollum not only won that contest, but she won by a convincing margin, and she joins us now. Good morning, Representative McCollum.
Good morning, Mr. Aitken.
50%. Were you surprised that you won by that with that total? All the other candidates way behind.
Well, we knew we were looking good, and we were picking up momentum when the lines would light up with people asking for lawn signs 2 days before the primary. But yes, we were pleasantly surprised by the large margin we won by.
Why do you think you won by such a handy margin?
Well, we had been working neighborhood to neighborhood, door to door, talking with families, listening to their concerns, and they were telling us they wanted a candidate that was going to work on addressing the looming healthcare crisis with prescription drugs with our senior and disabled populations, and someone who was going to fight strong for public education, continue Congressman Bento's legacy of protecting our environment, and then someone who would stand strong for Social Security for our elders and that's what our campaign's about. So that's what drove people towards us in the polls.
Can't talk with you without asking about the famous brochure that caused such a hubbub in the 4th District, the materials that the DFL party sent out in your support, but which attacked two other candidates, Steve Novak and Chris Coleman. Do you regret that that was mailed out?
Well, the party sent out a brochure which showed differences in actual votes between myself and my opponents, and they were actual, and they were factual, and the party put that out.
So no regrets?
The party did what it felt was necessary in order to make sure that this seat stayed Democratic.
Mm-hmm. Looking ahead to the November election now, there's a school of thought that says with Independence Party candidate Tom Foley in the race, longtime Democrat, that the two of you will carve up the Democratic vote in the 4th District and that Republican Linda Runbeck will be elected as a result.
Well, Mr. Foley has made a decision not to be a Democrat. I'm the only Democrat in the race.
Mm-hmm. How do you see that playing out, though? Is he a real threat to you or just another candidate?
Well, we'll have to see how his candidacy unfolds, but right now we're just going to stay on our message with education, health care, the environment, and fighting for family security.
Campaign starting today?
The campaign started this morning at 5:30.
No rest at all.
Oh, we're excited. This is an important election for the families in the 4th District, and we're excited to be on the ballot to represent families.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
State Representative Betty McCullum from North St. Paul, who is the DFL party's endorsed candidate and now the nominee in the 4th District Congressional race. That seat, of course, held by Bruce Vento, longtime congressman, who announced that he would not be seeking re-election this year because of his health problems. That opened up a congressional seat, and Chris Gilbert, that almost never happens, and a flood of candidates rushed to fill the void, and now we end up with a pretty interesting three-way race.
Yeah, it was unexpected. I think we would have thought Bruce Vento would have wanted to stick around for a few more years in Washington, D.C. He served the district very, very well. It is an interesting race. Foley is a wild card. When a third candidate is somebody who's run or been part of the major parties before, they tend to do better, though it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to make a huge splash. But it is a little bit of a wild card in the race, particularly since deserters who head into the middle party tend to come from the Republican side, not from the Democratic side, so that's a little bit different. The opportunity to send a woman to Washington is something that both the Democrats and Republicans in the state have wanted to do for quite some time, and that's another aspect of this race. The party endorsement helps. Senator Young made that point earlier. It helps at the lower levels and doesn't really help at all at the statewide level, but I think it certainly helps Betty McCollum. It was a mistake to attack fellow Democrats in a mailing. That just shouldn't happen. There are ways of supporting your candidate without getting into that. I don't think that has much backlash, because when you think of the alternatives in the 4th District, good DFLers are likely to line up behind Betty McCollum, regardless of how she got there. She might have won this race anyway. I think she did have a little bit of a head start and seems to have out-campaigned the other contenders in some respects.
Deb, a quick comment before we wrap up this segment on yesterday's primary?
Yes, I just had a comment about voting in the primaries, which I don't do, and a lot of people I know don't, because they have a difficult time voting along party lines. I tend to skip around and vote for the person who has most impressed me or I think can do the best job, and I don't like locking myself into either Republican or Democratic ticket.
Okay. Well, obviously you had a lot of company yesterday, Deb. 16.2% of the Minnesota voters actually voted in yesterday's primary. We're going to take a break now for Writer's Almanac, but Chris Gilbert will be here during the noon hour. We'll continue our discussion about yesterday's primary and look ahead to November as well.
I'm Lorna Benson on the next All Things Considered. In his new book, Do I Stand Alone? Governor Ventura refers to the media as jackals. A journalistic code of ethics is supposed to keep the media in line and honest. The Radio Television News Directors Association just updated their code for the first time in almost two decades. We'll have that story on the next All Things Considered, weekdays at 3 on Minnesota Public Radio, KNOW FM 91.1 in the Twin Cities.
5 minutes before 12.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 13th of September, 2000. It's the birthday of the South African photojournalist Kevin Carter, born in Johannesburg, 1960, in a comfortable white suburb. As a photographer, he worked for the Johannesburg Star, where he risked imprisonment exposing the true images of apartheid. In 1993, he paid his own way to the Sudan to take pictures of the civil war and the famine there, and took a photograph of a starving girl collapsing on her way to a feeding center with a vulture lurking in the background. It won a Pulitzer Prize in 1994. He said later that after taking the picture, he chased away the vulture, saw the toddler make her way to the feeding station, and then sat under a tree smoking cigarettes and crying. Several days after his Pulitzer Prize was announced, a close friend was shot dead near him while photographing a gun battle in South Africa, and 3 months later, Kevin Carter committed suicide. It's the birthday of the poet John Malcolm Brennan, born in Halifax, Nova Scotia, 1916. He wrote memoirs describing his friendships with Dylan Thomas and Truman Capote, and described poetry as the liveliest art, the most gloriously useless, and the most necessary. It's the birthday of Roald Dahl, born in Llandaff, Wales, 1916, of Norwegian parents, who preferred to be known for his adult fiction and for his memoirs Boy and Going Solo, but is best remembered for his children's stories, James and the Giant Peach and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It's the birthday of the jazz critic and songwriter Leonard Feather, born in London, 1914, who compiled the Encyclopedia of Jazz. It's the birthday of the father of bluegrass, Bill Monroe, born in Rosine, Kentucky, 1911, a great mandolin player and tenor singer. His main inspiration as a boy was his uncle Penn Vandiver, who played the fiddle, and about whom Bill Monroe later wrote the song Uncle Penn. He played with his brother Charlie for years, and then in 1938, when they broke up, Bill Monroe formed the Bluegrass Boys, a group that would include such great stars as Don Reno, Jimmy Martin, Carter Stanley, Vassar Clements, Chubby Wise, and Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs. It's the birthday of J.B. Priestley, John Boynton Priestley, born in Bradford, Yorkshire, 1894, author of many novels, including The Good Companions, and plays, including An Inspector Calls. It's the birthday of novelist Sherwood Anderson in Camden, Ohio, 1876, who wrote Winesburg, Ohio, sketches of small-town Middle America. And it's the birthday of Clara Schumann, born in Leipzig, 1819, who married Robert Schumann. She raised 7 children, composed music, and carried on a career as a pianist and a promoter of her husband's music and their friend Johannes Brahms's. Here's a poem for today by William Butler Yeats. He wishes for the cloths of heaven. Had I the heaven's embroidered cloths, enwrought with golden and silver light, the blue and the dim and the dark cloths of night and light and the half-light, I would spread the cloths under your feet. But I, being poor, have only my dreams. I have spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly, because you tread on my dreams. A poem by W.B. Yeats, He Wishes for the Cloths of Heaven, from the collected poems of